Hello, and thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are hundreds more of these conversations that you can get free of charge and with no ads because we're the ABC. Go to abc.net.au/conversations or just go to iTunes and search for Conversations with Richard Feidler. And while you're there, you can subscribe to this program if you like and have a conversation delivered to you every weekday automatically. It's easy.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, welcome to Conversations. One of the most famous paintings in the world hangs in a museum in Spain, in Madrid. The painting is by Pablo Picasso, and it's called Guernica. And it's huge and really quite overwhelming, and if you ever get the chance to see it, you really should, because no reproduction of Guernica ever does it justice. It's like a great big broken mirror of violence and horror. There's a woman carrying a dead child, there's a horse falling down in agony, and a light bulb that looks kind of like an evil eye. This was Picasso's response to an atrocity that was committed in the Spanish town of Guernica during the Spanish Civil War of the 1930s. Even though Spain is one of Europe's most sun-drenched countries, it tends to produce these artists who paint from the blackest shadows, like Goya, Velázquez, and Zabarin. Well, my guest for you today is Ana González. Ana is an artist and a teacher and an Australian citizen now, but she was born in Spain, and her early life was overshadowed by the Spanish Civil War and the rule of General Franco that followed it. Ana escaped from Spain with her husband, and she came here, but she was forced to return to Spain. She was suggested to us as a guest by Pippa Williams, and thank you for that, Pippa. And Ana's story is about being swept up in great events and how they cascade down through the generations and how to hold your family together under the most trying circumstances. Ana González, hello.
Hello, Richard.
Your paintings, what is it with the Spanish and the darkness or the black all the time with the Spanish when they paint? It's sunny when you go to Spain. It's lovely.
Yeah, it is lovely. But remember that we were educated and also it's in our genes, the Inquisition. We live through the Inquisition, even if we think that it's all long dead. We still have the spirit with us, and it's a very dark past, not only my generation, but in Goya's generation and so on. The church always had an enormous influence in our psyche.
You know, when I have guests on this program, Australian-born guests, you can often see how one event, specifically the First World War, cascade, its influence sort of comes down from generation after generation after generation.
That's right.
In Spain, though, it's even worse with the Spanish Civil War, isn't it? Its effect has sort of felt down from generation after generation.
Yes, and I think it's not only in Spain, in all countries that had to live a civil war. It's very different to have to be invaded, for example, in your country, that you have to fight your own brother and sister. These wounds never heal. So we inherited from our parents, and sadly, still very much so in our minds, especially my generation that lived through Franco, and then we tried to, not only me, but a lot of young people in the 1970s tried to fight and overthrow Franco. There were many, many victims from this time.
We have to start your story with your mum and dad. Mm-hmm. Your dad was born in France.
Yes, in Lyon.
Lyon, and came to Spain, to Catalonia, in North.
When he was 15.
When he was 15.
Yeah.
How was he caught up in the Civil War? How was your dad involved in the Civil War?
My father was an idealist, and he was 15 when he came to went to Barcelona, and he started to go to in school and then university. And he was, during the Republican time, the government. And he had free universities, the education, everything changed in Spain during these 3 years. So my father became a defender, you know. I just he
well, was he felt loyal to the Republic.
He felt loyal to the Republic, and he went as a volunteer. He only had he was 18 years old.
He was involved in one of the famous battles of the Civil War. The Battle of Ebro. Is that right?
That's right. Very few people survived that battle, and it was bombarded by, you know, Franco and Hitler. You know, because Hitler and also Mussolini helped Franco.
Yeah, it was their kind of like their trial run, wasn't it, for the Second World War?
Exactly,
yeah.
Because 6 months after the Civil War lost, it started the Second World War.
The Second World War. So what happened after after that battle? Where did your dad go?
He continued to fight. He was a member of the POMP, a revolutionary group. He continued to fight, but when they saw that they were losing the war, he tried to go to France. However, he was caught by Franco.
Was he imprisoned?
He was imprisoned in one of the most infamous places in Menorca, in a castillo of Mahón, a castle of Mahón. It was a medieval castle. And he was in prison for 8 years.
Was he tortured while he was in prison?
He was tortured, but also he was very ill during the time as well. Probably he survived because he was still young, but he had malaria. And my mother always said that from time to time he will get sick from
malaria. This is the island of Menorca, which is a kind of seaside playground for Europe now, isn't it?
It's
hard to believe there was a castle there which was torturing people once. Now, your mother had her own experience of the Civil War, which...
she was only 8 years old when her parents sent her, and when the Civil War started, and her parents sent her to near the Pyrenees for a place that a lot of the Republican children that they were from Republican families went there just to escape the horrors of war. What happened to my mother was that in 1939, all the carers that they were looking after these children, they were killed by Franco. So they were substituted by priests. Then my mother just was a victim of terrible treatment
by the priests. Were they being punished for being Republicans?
Exactly. Remember that the fascists always considered that Republicanism communism, and the children and the people were considered second or third class citizens. They didn't have any value for them. So these kids were constantly obliged to have, for example, cold showers in the middle of winter, very limited food, and insults. I'm convinced that influenced my mom. However, I still think that she was lucky to escape alive, because in 2006, it has been discovered that 35,000 kids had disappeared from 1939 to 1950.
Kids?
Yeah, children.
Under Franco's regime?
Yeah. What happened is that in 1939, started the Franco regime, pick up all these women that had any relation with Republican government, or their fathers or husband have been related to the Civil War in the Republican side. And they were put in prison. The mothers were put in prison. Some they were pregnant, and some they had little kids. A lot of these kids died of inanition, or that they didn't have enough food, or these kids were adopted to fascist families. The reason, the way they were doing that, is the nuns were changing the names of these kids. So nowadays it's very difficult to find out. We know by the survivors of some of these kids survive and still remember, but also some women that survive they tell the stories now of their children that disappear and never find out.
The cruelties of a civil war. Hmm. So your parents survived that civil war, despite sort of being, born into the and deciding to be on the wrong end of, well, not the wrong end, but the losing side of it. Franco goes on to rule Spain for, what, another 40 years after that? How did your parents meet then, Anna?
Well, my father, after 8 years, my father was free, but with the condition that every year he had to go to the civil guard. And
Probation, was
that's
it?
That's right, yeah. In probation. He was in probation for many, many years. I remember he doing that when I was a child. Yes, and they met in Barcelona. I don't know if in a dancing place or something like that. My mother was 19 only. She was very young. And they got married, yeah.
And you were born. Where were you in the lineup? Were you?
I'm the first.
The first?
Yes, and another three brothers.
Hmm. How old were you when your father died?
14.
What killed him, Anna?
I think probably the result of the malaria as well. He had also some breathing difficulties. All the time he was he had chest infections and so on. We don't know exactly. No one told us. But we think that probably was the result of that. So he was only 44, and probably is what you know. A lot of the malaria survivors, if they're not treated properly,
so there was your mum with a bunch of kids, and you was the oldest.
Yeah, the youngest was 1 year old. 1 year old.
How did your mum cope?
Not really well. My mum always had these panic attacks.
Anxieties
and insecurity in herself.
So well, she'd been traumatised as a kid.
She was traumatised as a kid as well. And remember that all the years of Franco were all the time, you know, notorious for a complete silence. Then all this pain you had to carry with you. And they never talked to their children about just because they wanted to protect us.
So there was this kind of thing after the Civil War was finished then that Franco's forces had won and no one was going to talk about the Civil War ever again?
No, no one was going to talk. And nobody did. And in a way, I remember that it was just to protect us, because when I went to school, primary school, I remember that the priest approaching me and asking me how my parents were talking about, what they were talking about Franco, if they like Franco or not, you know.
What the priest, like acting like secret police?
Yes.
In that sense.
Oh, they acted as a secret police. But in my innocence, if I didn't know anything, I couldn't talk, and it's why my parents never mentioned anything.
Mm. Anna Gonzalez is my guest. She's an artist and teacher who escaped from Franco's Spain to settle here in Australia. Went back and forth a few times, and the story of that is coming up. How did your mum manage to put food on the table then for you? How did she provide for the
children?
Well,
she worked two jobs. She was a hairdresser. Then she will work in a salon during the day, and at night he will work selling soft drinks in a coffee bar.
So she had two jobs?
Two jobs.
So who looked after the other kids? Was it you?
I did. I became a mum suddenly at 14.
What, you cooked for them and
yes,
got them
I
all to school?
Yes, I cooked for them. Yes, yes.
What, a one-year-old baby as well?
With a one-year-old baby, yes.
How did you cope? Anna, that's a lot of responsibility.
Amazing, because my responsibility was so strong, and I loved so much the love that I felt for my brothers was so strong as well, that I never complained or anything. I thought it was a natural thing to do.
Your mum was falling apart a little bit, though, after a while, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was. I had one day I called the doctor because we were desperate. She was more and more depressed. And then the doctor said that she had to go to a psychiatric hospital. So I panicked then, because I thought if I didn't have the unit of family that she was, I was going to lose my brothers too. Then I begged the doctor not to do it. And he said, okay, but next time, if your mother hasn't improved, I will I never call him again, and I deal with the problem.
What about school? Were you able to go to school and look after your brothers and sisters yourself?
No, when I was 14, when my father died, I stopped going to school.
Was your mother relying on you more and more
yes.
this time?
Yes. Yes. I think she relied on everything on me. For me, it was difficult because even if she relied on me, when I tried to talk to her to understand that she shouldn't be that sad, that she had something to live for, she didn't understand that.
So you're getting older all the time, though,
yes.
and you're a teenager now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was she telling you what? I don't know. Who was running the house? Was she still? Were you having to obey her orders still, though?
No. Yeah. Yes. Very much so. I had to care for the kids in a way that I had to give them a lot of love and so on, because not every day my mother was sick, but at the moments that she was sick, of course I had to be there for everybody. But my mother was very possessive, and I think
possessive of you.
Yes, I think it's fear. It was fear. No, she wanted me to do everything as the way she wanted to. What I mean is that she will tell me how many hours I could go out, or the boyfriend. I couldn't have any boyfriends because the boyfriend had to be at home and sit down with mom and talk to her.
And you weren't happy about that.
No.
So how did you get out from under that then, from your mother's control?
Well, I met my husband in a party that my mother was in, and of course, because every party that we had, my mother had to be there.
She was your chaperone.
That's right. And I met this young man, and my mother liked him. And then the next step, she said, well, you're not going out with him if he doesn't come to meet me. And of course, he came.
He came? How was your mother once? How was she when she met him? Was she nice to him, or did she treat him like the man who was going to take his precious daughter away?
No, she was nice. She was nice, yeah. But, of course, it was understood that everything that we were going to go, she will come with us. And my future husband accepted that.
But then you and your future husband decided you needed to leave.
We had to leave. It was impossible.
Why?
After 4 years, having mum all the time.
So you were running more from your mother than from Franco at that point?
Yes, at that point. But also, my future husband said
that's pretty bad when you're more scared of your mum than Franco, isn't
yes.
it?
I mean, but my future husband said, we don't have life here. It's no future for us. We have to go away.
So what did you consider? You considered
I didn't consider anything. I, because my life was with my mum and my brothers. Then I just waited until what he decided. And he just put up an application to Germany and Canada and Australia to migrate.
And Australia said yes.
That was the first country that said yes.
Now, you'd had very limited education at that point. Did you even know what Australia was, or have any idea of what Australia
didn't know
was?
Yes, I didn't know what Australia was.
Is it just a kangaroo in a paddock or something in
something
your mind?
Something like that. No, I imagined that was the most wonderful country. Always I imagined
oh,
that.
Really? Yeah. Seriously?
Yeah, because I didn't know Brisbane existed, but I knew Sydney and Melbourne. Yeah.
So you're aware. When you came to Australia, what was that like arriving in Australia? I'm sure you had a picture in your head, and then you arrived in Australia in the city of Brisbane.
Yeah, we came to Brisbane without a choice. We, the authorities told us Brisbane is the only destination, and we came here, and I was shocked because Barcelona is, even with Franco, was a very cosmopolitan city. And Brisbane was
really good coffee. Really good coffee in Barcelona.
That's right.
Great food. all those things, Gaudi architecture, all
yes,
of that.
Yes, Gaudi, yes.
And there you are in Joe's Brisbane. And this is what, the 1960s or something by then, Anna?
No, it was in 1973.
1973 you came, okay,
yes,
into Brisbane and birthdays. Yeah. And what did you make of the town then? What did you think once you arrived?
I thought it was a country town. I loved the vegetations and the gardens and the jacarandas. I thought they were amazing. But I remember the trains. it looked to me like the Far West a little bit.
And what was your English like when you got here?
Zero.
Zero? Yeah. All right. So how did you communicate?
Well, we went to Wakel. Wakel was a place just like a hostel for migrants. And they were giving English classes, and I started straight away.
How did you get on? You arrived without, I don't know, a cent to your name, didn't you? I mean, you didn't have any money to speak of.
No money at all.
No money at all.
No, even the Australian government paid our trip to come here.
So then, how did you get on once you arrived for money?
Well, we were quite protected while we were in Wakel in a hostel, because meals were provided to us and a bed and so on. And my husband started to work straight away. He was a fitter and turner. And we started to earn money very quickly.
Living the Australian dream
Straight away. Yes, straight away.
Meanwhile, how was your mum getting on back home?
Well, my mother was very very supportive, because the first thing we told her was that we were going to be only 2 years here. That was the stipulation that the Australian government said. They paid the trip, but you must stay 2 years. And the idea was to come back to Spain.
Okay. Meanwhile, she met someone else, hadn't
yes.
she? She remarried, so she was happy to some
yes,
degree.
Yes, yes.
Your first baby arrived soon after?
In 1974.
1974, in Australia. And so, wasn't that the year of the Great Brisbane flood?
Yeah, after 2 weeks after the floods. No, 2 weeks before the floods, my son was born, yes.
So did you encounter difficulty settling into the new culture? Was it awkward for you? Did you make friends easily in Brisbane without much
Well,
language?
At the beginning we didn't make many friends, but I had one Australian friend from the beginning. It was Vicky Hooker. She was an English teacher. She was my teacher, and we became friends.
So you had a beautiful son, and then the joy didn't last.
No. Just a year later, my husband thought that he had a chest congestion, but he didn't have any symptoms of flu. And then we decided just to go to the doctor. The doctor, when he saw him, straight away sent him to Prince Charles Hospital. And he was diagnosed there with mesothelioma. It's an asbestos-originated cancer.
So he had mesothelioma.
Mesothelioma, yeah.
How did he contract mesothelioma? At what point was he close to asbestos? How did he?
Born in front of the factory.
He was born in front of an asbestos factory.
That's right. In Spain, then everything was allowed, and the factory were in the middle of the little town that my husband was living. The streets were totally white from asbestos. The kids would play with the sacks on the weekends because everything was open. And
God, is anyone in that village alive?
No. Many, many people died after, yeah. I think in a way we were, in brackets, we were lucky that we were here, because it was put a name to his illness. A lot of people that in that generation that died from asbestos or were ill from mesothelioma as well, the doctors gave them other names like pleurisy or
consumption or something like that.
Yes, because they were trying to hide everything.
How did the doctor tell you that? I mean, how did the doctor tell you that your husband had mesothelioma?
Just like that. Your husband has mesothelioma. And I didn't know what it was that. I asked her to explain, and he said, well, it's an asbestos-related cancer. And
how long did he give your husband to live?
A year and a half or the most, but he lived 3 years. And then my first reaction was, don't tell him, I will tell him. And the doctor said, too late, he already knows. And the shock of the moment is incredible. It's like a cloud has come over you. You cannot think. And, you know, everything is desperate. You're looking for an exit or something, a solution. And every time you say, well, we'll try different things. And the doctor said, no, it's nothing. He will die. And, yeah, it was a very, very difficult time.
You must have thought of your mother. Your mother had been through all of this. Her husband had died. You know, your father
Yes,
died.
In a way, it was a strange coincidence that I was losing my husband as well. Although I was only 25 or
so. So what discussion, then you had to talk about your future with your husband. What did he say?
My husband, of course, he was sorry that he wasn't going to see his kid grow and myself to spend a life together. But his reflections in life helped me later on a lot. He said that he considered that he should go to Spain, we should go to Spain, because he wanted to die there. The reason was to see at least that I was among family, and we didn't have any family here.
So he didn't want you to be left in Brisbane just with the son on your own, where you couldn't speak much English. So So you agreed to go back to Spain?
Well, I wasn't convinced because I knew that Spain wasn't just everything was fixed because by that time Franco already died.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Today you're hearing the story of Ana Gonzalez. Ana is an artist and a teacher. She lives in Australia now. She was born in Spain. The effects of the Spanish Civil War affected her family really greatly, her mum and dad. She came to Australia with her husband. They had a child once they'd settled in Australia, and then her husband was diagnosed with mesothelioma in the mid-1970s, a disease he'd contracted from growing up in a town, believe it or not, right next to an asbestos factory. Your husband said, well, it'd be best if we went back to Spain so you'd be around family. So what was that like for you then to pick up and go back to Spain after being in Australia? How long had you been here at that stage, in Australia at that stage?
2 years.
2 years. Yeah, you'd started to make a life here.
Yes.
And you had to, and you had to go back.
Well, and the life, because he was diagnosed so early here, we never had a definite settlement. You know, because we couldn't buy a house. He was sick, and you know, it was a very difficult life as well here.
So. You found the sort. You knew what the source of your husband's disease was.
And yes.
You went back to Spain, but by the time you got back there, Franco had died by then, hadn't he?
He died in 1975. However, the King of Spain that he groomed, Franco groomed the King of Spain to become a successor, he decided that. The only way that Spain could, join the Europe and so on was to have a democracy. So he instigated that, he said that, that we were going to have elections and, you know.
So that's right. Spain changed and became a constitutional monarchy and a democratic society.
That's right.
So when you were there, but then back in Spain, though, nonetheless, was there any assistance for you as someone?
Not at all. The thing is, Spain had become a democracy. However, the institutions were exactly the same. And the silence is still there. There was there then. Nobody said anything, and many things went wrong. For example, when we arrived, I had to go to charity because he didn't have the right to have a hospital, and assistance. Then it was very difficult. I was with a man that was dying and nowhere to go. Although I had my family that tried to support, it was a very major problem that suddenly they encounter as well.
It's a horrible way to die. How long did he hang on for once you returned to Spain?
Oh, around 7 months more, yeah. And he died, and he died of a horrible death, yeah.
And once he died, what were you like after that?
Oh, I had to go to my mother's place. I was devastated, and I knew I had to rebuild my life because I had a child. However, I didn't have the will to do that. It took me a while, and I went to Tremp, that it's a beautiful place, and I had a lot of reflection and meditation and thinking about life. And then I started to look for a job. It was very difficult.
Sorry, once you'd had some time to think and reflect about life, what did you conclude? Did you come to any conclusions? Did you make up your mind about what life was like and what life was like for you?
Yes, I thought that life was beautiful. Although I was full of pain, I had the most wonderful child with me. And I had people that my family, and I have friends, and you know, I thought I had to survive for him, for my child. And
so you decided life was beautiful.
It is beautiful, even if in the darkest time, I learned to appreciate to having a shower, the hot water, the flowers, the sun. You know, every day, the birds that sing in the morning, that's the most precious thing that you can imagine.
Do you think you saw what your mother had done and how depressed your mother had been? And, you know, there are all sorts of reasons why people are that way.
Yes.
Do you think, I'm just wondering if you thought, I will not be like that. I will be different.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. This gave me a strength in my character.
I'm not saying either that anyone can do that either. I just think that's just something like that.
No. I knew I had to be the mother and father for my child, but also I didn't want him to go through what we went through, not only myself, my brothers too.
Where did you get a job?
I was offered a job because I couldn't find a job before, because a lot of people thought that because having a child, it would be difficult for a woman to work. So I was offered a job in the same place that my husband died, in a hospital. However, I had to humiliate myself looking at the same factory, putting loads of money into that hospital and paying the doctors money as well, or giving them grants to America.
The asbestos factory that had created the asbestos.
Yeah.
That killed your husband and other people.
Yeah,
was giving money to the hospital.
That's right.
And paying for doctors
to do some research in asbestos, but in at the same time, I think they were trying to keep everybody quiet, because when my husband died, I took the case to court. I took the factory to court, and the autopsy papers disappeared, and the case was dismissed.
So even though Spain had become democratic, there's still shocking corruption.
Yeah.
Did that leave you bitter?
For many years it did. I'm not bitter anymore. Bitter in the sense that the injustice that was carried on. But remember, my case is not isolated. There were many, many people that suffer injustices in Spain. However, I have to say that coming to Australia has helped to heal this pain. And I used to ignore many, many things about the Civil War, why, you know, Franco survived so many years without, you know, being punished or changed. And one of the things I learned was in Australia by an old man, that he said that he knew a lot of about Spain, and he said that he was part of the international brigade. We never knew that we had international brigades in Spain during the Civil War.
George Orwell was part of the international brigade.
Yeah, but we were not allowed to read these books. Freud theories, for example, were forbidden. Surrealism was forbidden in Spain too. You know,
a country that produced Dali and Miró.
Yeah, but Dali, it's a case because he was already famous when he was able to live in Spain, and he proclaimed all the time that he was a sympathizer of Franco.
Yeah, well, he bit of a nut job, old Dali, though.
That's right.
came to his politics, though. Yeah. So you're there in Spain, and you got the job in the hospital, which has been, you know. And you've got a son. That's when you met your second husband.
That's right.
How did you meet him?
Well, I met him through a friend that we have here in Australia, a Spanish friend. And Gemma and Sebastian, that they become later on my family too. Sebastian went to Spain because his father was very ill. He had a heart attack. And then he didn't want to leave Spain without coming and see me. And he came and visit me with his brother. That his brother is my husband today.
What did you like about him?
Oh, he had this charm in him. He smiled. And also, I must say, I knew about him. He had been in prison as well for political reasons, and he was tortured. And while we were living here in Australia, Sebastian was to talk to me about Thomas, my husband today, that he spent 5 years in prison.
And Thomas had been married previously too, hadn't he?
Yes, while he was imprisoned. He went to prison 2 weeks after marrying his wife, Maria. And during the time he was in prison, his wife died from breast cancer.
So you'd both lost a spouse to different forms of cancer then?
Yeah, I think also this Stradaway was a connection for us.
Because you knew what you'd been through.
Exactly. And for the first time, we were able to speak about our spouses. And sometimes people think that, oh, well, you shouldn't talk. Well, that's not the case. That's not the case because I feel affection for Maria and I'm sure Thomas feels affection for Andreu.
How quickly did this relationship develop then, Anna?
Well, it was so quickly because we had the censorship of my family straight away. I met a man. And my intention was just to live with him because I didn't know how I was going to influence Javier, my son. But my family, they didn't want that.
They didn't approve?
No, they didn't approve. And even,
why not?
Well, we had to get married. That was the only. That was the only way we could have a relationship. Then 2 months later, we got married.
So who was it that thought that coming back to Australia would be a good idea? Was it you or was it Thomas?
No,
your husband?
Thomas. I was already working. Thomas, I think because of the time he spent in prison, he wasn't happy. He wanted to look for other horizons. And because Sebastian was here in Brisbane. And also, an important factor was that it was an attempt of coup d'etat in 1981.
That's right. Yeah, a bunch of...
Tejero.
Yeah, the soldiers sort of ran into the parliament and pointed guns at everyone. And then, but then the king shut that down, didn't he?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But my husband at the police, he has the, you know, the documentation says that he's a terrorist. Then we knew if the coup d'etat prosper, my husband will be caught. Then Stradaway went to the Australian embassy and I said, well, this is what is happening. Then he had to write, and it was, thanks to the Australian embassy, and they decided that my husband was on threat and we were able to come.
So back in Brisbane, in Australia.
Yes.
Was it as easy as you'd hoped it would be, being back in Australia?
Yeah, it was much easier. I came here to Australia expecting my second child, Roger. I was 7 months pregnant then. but I was able to speak English, at least some English. And it was much easier. And also my husband, he's a ballet maker. Well, then he was able to find a job straight away.
Did he adjust to life in Australia well to begin with?
Wonderfully. He never for once said that he wanted to go back to Spain. I think he's a happy, happy man.
And you had another son?
Yes, Roger was born, yeah.
And Roger now presents on Classic FM occasionally,
ABC right.
Classic FM.
That's so right. Yeah, he became a musician. He's a musician, yes.
So within months of having your second son, Roger, you were back at work. What kind of work was that?
We were living in Dara then, and the local school were looking for teacher aides. And then I went to work in that school for Vietnamese kids. And that was very good because I started to see that probably I could have a future if I was going back to study and become a teacher. That was my dream. But however, I thought my English was not up to scratch. So I didn't feel confident. So I decided to do a course in something that probably was easier and that something manual like art. And I decided to go to QCA, do an arts course.
What kind of course did you think it was going to be?
Just a craft course. Something like that. And they were going to teach me everything. But on that year was the first time that the QCA was offering a Bachelor of Arts. Being an ambitious person and naive, I said, I want to do that course. Then I had to pretend that I have done art before. So in the interview, I said that when they asked me, where is your folio? And I said, well, my folio is in Spain, of course. It's the last thing you bring here.
I'm trying to escape Franco, man.
Yeah.
I don't have time to bring my portfolio. So it was like that.
So then the interviewee said, well, you have 4 weeks to put your folio together. And of course, I went home feeling totally deflated. And I thought, oh my God, I never going to do.
Had you ever done any art in your life?
Never. We had a fascist education. Art was the worst, the last thing they teach us.
So what did you do? How did you get your folio together?
Well, Thomas said, no way you're going to say no. You have to try, at least try. And then I get color pencils because I couldn't get any brush. And I did some drawings with charcoal and color pencils, and I draw my cat, my kids. If I look back, I could see very naive stuff.
So then you started to do the course. And this is all really, I suppose, about you just trying to improve your English. And here you are doing fine art.
Yeah, in the interview, it was a fluke. I was accepted. I never thought that I was going to be accepted in the course. And my first day was the painting class.
And how did that go?
And on those days, they provide the materials to the students. So the tutor put a boiler. The boiler was these artifacts that you used to boil the clothes in that places, and then he wrapped it up around with some kind of string and cardboard. And
you had to paint a boiler.
Yes,
wrapped up in string and cardboard.
That's right.
Okay, right.
So
you're expecting a naked person, perhaps, instead of a boiler wrapped
up
in string
and
cardboard.
Actually, I didn't expect anything. I didn't know. I thought they were going to say, okay, this is yellow, this is green.
Well, I don't know if it had been... if I was going to my first life drawing class and I'd been given a boiler wrapped in string and cardboard instead of a naked person, I might feel a little disappointed. But nonetheless, so how did you go painting your boiler wrapped in string and cardboard?
Well, the thing is, I felt frustrated. And I pick up the brush and I soak it in some color, some paint. And I started to throw the brush on the canvas.
Action painting.
Yes, and I started. I can see the physical movement, the thrills that I was doing was really with a lot of anger, and I was swearing at the same time in Spanish, knowing that no one understood me because I thought it was that was the end of me that day.
So what happened when you handed this swirling painting?
Well, I didn't hand it. The tutor went around looking at everybody. And then he said, Anna, can you bring yours here? And everybody were in the circle. And I thought, well, this man is just going to nail me now, you know. I just wanted to disappear. And he looked at mine and said, well, obviously Anna has been influenced by Vincent Van Gogh. And I thought, who is that? But I said, yes, I'm influenced by him. And then I went run home and looked who Vincent Van Gogh was.
But rather being, you know, sort of enchanted by A Starry Night, you were actually just, I don't know, putting decades of pent-up rage against the Spanish Civil War, the system.
I think it, yeah.
The unfairness of it all. That was really what it was.
I think so, yes.
Did your art improve? How did you go from there?
Well, to tell you the truth, without help, probably I wouldn't be here today as an artist. I had a lot of help, especially from a young man in that class. That he's a Colombian, and he was doing in the course as well, and he had 2 years' experience. Then we speak the same language, and then he said, "I'll try to help you. I'll tell you which books to read and so on." And then we just grow a friendship, and he helped me a lot in orientating me in art.
Once you had a direction, what did you start to create? What images were you creating?
I was the first one to be surprised because I always thought that I would go and do an art course and paint flowers and beautiful things. But all these monsters started to come out. And I used to paint dead people. In
cadavers,
yes, in sitting positions or dancing. Or, for example, three cadavers as the three graces. I used to have black humor and morbid stuff, and that didn't go really well with tutors at QCA.
Have you seen, you know, that picture of the famous etching, I think, by Goya, you know, the Sleep of Reason produces monsters,
yeah,
you know, the
right.
Artist slumped on his desk and these strange, you know, monsters
flying
are swirling,
flying
things are swirling out of his head. Were you seeing some of this art at the time?
No. I never was exposed to that.
You were creating this stuff without ever being exposed to Spanish art.
Yes. I was totally ignorant about the Spanish art because they kept us ignorant about everything.
Anna Gonzalez, teacher and artist, is my guest in conversation. Were you surprised by these pictures you were creating?
I was surprised, disappointed.
Disappointed?
I felt like I was a failure. Yeah, because I wasn't able to produce something. It was a kind of anger that I had in myself.
What did you think art was for at that point? What did you think? It sounds like you thought it was to produce nice pictures.
That's right. Yeah.
But art's not therapy. Art is not therapeutic. It should not be therapeutic. It's about it's about truth rather than
exactly.
Niceness, isn't it?
But I had to learn that. I didn't know at that time. And I was disappointed. And also I had some tutors that they didn't understand either. But some did. So I started to look, at the European art, and then I was exposed to Goya, and then I started to read books. It took me maybe 2 or 3 years to really understand that what I was doing, it was okay. It wasn't beautiful, but it was okay.
And how are other people responding to your work? You say that you tend to get different reactions from people to the artwork you're creating.
Yeah, I remember two incidents. I had an exhibition near the City Hall. It was a small gallery there. And I was sitting at the desk, and all my paintings were around the gallery. And this couple came in and said, oh, this man probably had lived all his life in the Cara. I discovered one thing, that first of all, they thought it was a man. They never thought that this short lady sitting on the desk was the one that produced these enormous paintings, but they were very big, 2 meters big. you know,
I thought you were Hitler, essentially.
Yes.
You know, Hitler produced paintings while living in the gutter, essentially.
That's right. That's right. And the other thing, well, I was invited at, University of Queensland to talk about art. And when I started with my slides, it was a profound silence. And I was just happily showing all these cadavers.
What do you think you were painting? What were those pictures? I mean, they're cadavers, but what was coming out? What do you think?
Some of them were my dreams. For example, I still kept one that it's a monkey holding a white bird, and the bird is dead and is being devoured by vultures, and the monkey is holding it, feeling confused. And that was a dream I had. Then I didn't hesitate to paint that. But if I analyze that, probably it's my own life.
Once you produced some of these things, did you stand back and go, what on earth is that about?
Yes.
Did you confuse yourself?
I was confused, yeah.
And do you know what you were creating there? Do you have a better idea of what that is?
Then I started to know what I was creating. And also I had a very good Australian friend, Brenda Lewis. She was an artist as well. And she was an anarchist and wonderful woman. And she was very supportive. She started to tell me what all my paintings were about.
You said some angry things about nuns and representatives of the Catholic Church in Spain and the unpleasant things that they did. Did I see you cross yourself before you started? I mean,
yes.
What's your religious what's your religious status now?
I'm the most atheist Catholic.
The most atheist Catholic.
Yes, because I think it's in my genes. Religion is in my genes and cannot get rid of it. It's like a virus. So I have to learn how to live with it and accept it. And these are all the time these contradictions in my life. You know, I don't believe, but at the same time, I cannot do anything without just, giving the sign of a cross first.
Are you resigned to these contradictions now? Are you not
resigned?
Oh, yeah.
I'm in peace. I'm in peace with that. I have to accept it because part of it also, it made me the person who I am now. I had to investigate about the kind of surrealism that we have in Spain that is differs a lot from this French surrealism. And the Spanish surrealism, it grows from inside out.
Anna, you're a fascinating person. I've so enjoyed talking with you today. Thank you so much for being my guest in conversation.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.